Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are taking the Crab Cake Tour back out on the road. It's all presented by our friends at the Maryland Lottery, as well as Goodwill Industries. We will be at Greenmount Station this week, eating crab cakes, delicious crab cakes, I might add. We're heading to G&A Coney Island Hot Dog, no longer in Highlandtown, now in White Marsh on Philadelphia Road, and a fantastic diner. And Andy has a sign there in neon that says, with Baltimore from Baltimore with love, almost like from Russia with love. And this guy will appreciate the Baltimore part of this. Conrad's Crabs on the 27th for the Crab Cake Tour. Last thing. Don, I'm going to let you do the honors because maybe I just set it up with Andy's place over at in White Marsh. From Baltimore with love. This guy is that guy, right?
Oh, my goodness. You know, long time Sun columnist, WJZ commentator, author of many, many books, including one that now that I have finished his latest book, which we're going to talk about today, Boogie, Life on a Merry-Go-Round. And Nestor always makes fun of me, Michael, with my little tabbies up here. But
school teacher.
After reading
school
this,
teacher.
I had to buy your cult book, The Love Story, and now that I have finished this in about 2 days because I couldn't put it down, next on my list, I'm on a Olesker-a-thon. I'm going to the to the cult book. Michael Olesker, welcome.
Thank you so much to both of you.
Olesker, I just want to let you know, before we had you on, we had Feinstein on, and I went touching books in my library looking for various things and whatever, and I came across a whole stack of Stedman. You know, so when you say Colts books, these fingers touch the Stedman books today, the blue, you know, binders on the outside and the white, like white print.
John Stedman was a great inspiration to many of us. Who came up in the 50s and the 60s and were, you know, passionate about sports. I started out as a sports writer.
Really?
John Stedman.
Just like me?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
At the News American. But even before that, I was 13 years old and I became a paper boy for the old News Post and Sunday American. And John was the brand new sports columnist there at that time. And he really helped ignite my passion about sports because he was writing not only about home runs and field goals and that kind of stuff, but about the human element behind it. And I would deliver the paper every day and come home and read his column. You know, when you're 13 years old, you're just... you're reading the comics and the sports, and the rest of it is, you know, might as well be written.
I think he's talking about both of our childhoods, right, Don?
Exactly. And then you cut an occasional article out for the required current events class.
Right. Exactly.
You did find an occasional article that you cut out about Hyman Pressman or someone else.
Yeah. Mike, I would say this to you, because I talked to John Feinstein about this, and we had Dan Rodericks on, many times. We'll get him on again. Just, you guys were crazy uncles to me, as was Don in the 1980s when I was a kid. And all I wanted to be, I didn't want to be you. I wanted to be Stedman. I wanted to be Oscar Madison. I wanted to be a sports columnist in a newspaper. I thought that's all I was ever going to do. You know, I always tell a story. My dad died in the summer of 1992. He was so disappointed with me when he died because I had left the newspaper. I had turned down the gold watch in 1992. He was so disappointed. And, I'm thinking of taking up sports writing again and becoming a modern columnist. What would your advice be for what a columnist should be in a traditional sense?
Well, the difference, let's make the distinction between a reporter and a columnist. The reporter goes out and tells you what he or she has found and says, here are the facts. A columnist or a commentator does the same thing, but says, here are the facts, and here's what I think about them. Here's my opinion about them. If you're a young person today coming up and you want to get into journalism, you know, just look at what's happened in Baltimore. It's the shrinking of the extinction of newspapers, which is a tragedy for any community and is going on all over America, not just in Baltimore. We may be getting lucky here in that this new website is going to start in a couple of months called the Baltimore Banner, which will be competition for what remains of the Sun, which is good. Competition is good for both of them, for all of us, because it means we're going to get more of the news. We're going to get more of the facts. We're going to get more of the opinion, and we'll get colliding opinions, which is okay. The more we know about what's going on, the better it is for all of us. But today, it's not just newspapers that are losing circulation. And the Sun, you know, in my day there, we probably had close to 250,000 circulation. They have maybe a tenth of that now. When I was at WJZ, and I remember my first night on the air, you know, I'm dying. I'm so nervous. And I sit down next to Jerry Turner and
how many times you rehearsed that script that night? Because Don and I both sat in that seat back in the 80s trying to get Chris Ealy's job. And I still wet myself thinking about sitting next to Buren, you know. But okay. The first time I sat there, I remember the prompter. It was the 1980s, probably the same setup that you wound up reading from. I rehearsed that thing 50 times before I went in. You had to have been the same, right?
Let me tell you what happened. First of all, the first night there, I sit down next to Jerry Turner and Al Sanders. And I'm nervous as could be. It's live television. And one of the cameramen says to me, relax, there's only going to be 500,000 people watching you tonight. That's all I needed to hear. All right, so now it's my third night on the air. I'm still sweating bullets, right? It's the night Mayor Schaefer's mother died. So I figured I'll do a piece on her. You know, he lived with her his entire life. Had a profound effect. Okay, as you said, I typed up my commentary in the teleprompter script, you know, so that when you look into the camera, you're reading the script that you have read, that you have written an hour or two earlier. Jerry Turner says, as we told you earlier, the mayor's mother died today. Here with a commentary is Michael Olesker. What I didn't know, what Jerry didn't know, what Al didn't know, was that someone forgot to put my script into the teleprompter.
Oh, no.
I'm sitting there on my third night on the air, petrified, and I look into the camera and there's nothing there. My first thought was, I must be having a nervous breakdown. There's nothing there. What have I gone blind? What's going on? I think, oh, maybe I'm looking into the wrong camera. There's three of them in the room. I start going like this. Back at people at home must have thought his head's on a swivel. There's nothing there in any of them. I'm having this nervous breakdown. They say when you die, your entire life passes in front of you. This is like death, but at least portions of my commentary flashed in front of my eyes, and I stumbled through it. We broke for a commercial. I stood up. I stepped over the puddle that I had just created on the floor. Al Sanders looks up and he says, that's the best thing that could have happened to you. I said, really? He said, yeah, if you got through that, you can get through anything. That gave me some courage. I made my own share of mistakes after that, but if you get through the worst of it, you can get through anything.
From an art form perspective, writing, go ahead.
I'm losing you here, Nestor.
Go ahead, Mike. Go ahead. We got you, Mike.
You froze.
Go ahead.
We've got you.
Okay. Not only have newspapers lost circulation, television stations also. That 500,000 people that were watching WJZ back in the glory days of Jerry Turner and Al Sanders, they're maybe getting 10,000 households now. And BAL, which is a leader, is getting a few more than that. MAR is getting very few. You know, people used to tune in at 11 o'clock to see what the weather report was. They're looking at their phones all day long. The culture of news has changed dramatically now. The audiences have shrunk, and they've got to give them a new reason to tune in and see what's going on there. Their credibility.
Michael Lester is our guest. I want to reset here because we were having a little technical difficulties with Mike. Don Mueller is also here. We're doing some Baltimore Positive and catching up with Mike, not just about his work at Jaymore, as well as his book on Boogie Wineglass. Last thing on the columnist thing, because I was asked about this recently. I wrote a thing called The Moon that I sort of in my mind in about 2006, 7, and 8, when I went off the radio, I decided to do what you did. I mean, you were part of an inspiration of this. Write a piece that was meant to be spoken, you know, on the radio primarily. There was no video at that point. When you wrote for television, a completely different art form than writing in the paper, probably even in a different voice, certainly edited differently into 60 or 75 seconds, 90 seconds, whatever they gave you, as opposed to 24 inches or 30 inches or what a column would be. Writing in that voice, what was that Paul Harvey to you as well? The rest of the story, your delivery was very much like that on television.
The first week I was there, Jerry Turner gave me some advice. He said, be yourself. If you try to be somebody else, they see through it right away and they resent it. I think that's good advice for anyone, whether they're writing for print or writing online or delivering it live on television. Be yourself. Speak in your own voice. The newspaper column was about 2.5 times as long as the TV commentary. You're right. That's a kind of haiku. You really have to boil it down. It's a minute and a half. So you really don't get to say nearly as much as you do within the context of a newspaper column. But I tried.
And you probably stunk at it at the beginning, writing 2 minutes and 15 seconds.
Beginning and at the end.
You had to cut it down, always.
For 20 years on the air, I was, you do the best you can, and that's all you can do. But I tried to make it colloquial, tried to make it talking in my own voice.
We are with Michael Lester, longtime Baltimore Sun columnist, WJZ commentator. He has written a new book, one of his many books, Boogie, Life on a Merry-Go-Round. And one of my challenges, Michael, and hopefully we can do this during the interview, is that I wanted to make sure that the three of us didn't lapse into inside baseball today, assuming that everyone that's listening knows the history of Boogie and the Diner and Levinson and Matz and the whole thing. And I thought we've got to make it big picture. And one of the things that I was struck by, it's a magnificent book. I think I said on social media that if you're from Baltimore, and I capitalized it, you will love this book. But even if you're not, you will really love this book. It's that good. The first paragraph to me is vintage Olesker in that it paints a picture of what's about to come. And you write, in his chaotic youth on the streets of mid-century Baltimore, Leonard Boogie Wineglass confronted all financial difficulties with a series of hustles, some legal, ranging from 2-cent deposits on swiped soda bottles to football pools to the blank report cards he sold to classmates looking to sneak a fast one past unsuspecting parents. Such activities across a lifetime will fall somewhere between a misdemeanor and a smile. If you can read that and not want to race through the rest of the book, God bless you.
Thank you.
With that,
this Runyon-esque sort of character, right? Like lends itself to writing about
you
him,
know, Nestor.
Right?
Nestor, one of the things that I think you and I have always had in common is an appreciation for characters. And Baltimore has always had great characters. And by that, I mean people who don't particularly edit themselves. They are who they are, whether it's Mimi DiPietro or Barbara Mikulski or Tommy D'Alessandro.
Or Mayor Schaefer or Charlie Ekman or John Steadman. We can go through the list.
Yes. And Leonard Boogie Wineglass is a great character from the time he was a kid through now, when he's 80 years old, but he's still a great kid at heart. And, you know, a lot of people know the name Boogie from Barry Levinson's movie Diner. And that was part of the story. I mean, that part is real. Boogie did that stuff that he did in the movie, he did it in real life. But the
when did you meet Boogie? When's the first time you okay. met him?
Well, he and I were at City College together. He started out at Bryce Park, went to City, got kicked out, went to Mervo, got kicked out, got back into City College.
What did you get? What got you kicked out of high school in 1953? What would you do?
He first got kicked out, I guess, around 1960. They borrowed a teacher's car.
Borrowed.
He hotwired it, and it wasn't malicious. He brought it back at the end of the period, but unfortunately, the police were waiting. And most of the time when he got kicked out, it was for fighting. So I'm at City College, and I'm walking down a hallway one day. He was a terrific basketball player, though. And I'm in the 10th grade, and a classmate says to me, pointing down the hall, he says, "See that guy over there? That's Boogie Wineglass. He's an important guy." I said, "Why? Because he's on the basketball?" He said, "No, because he's the guy to go to if you need a blank report." Which, as it happens, I did, but that's a different story. But that's how I knew who he was the first time. He was also a terrific basketball player. The first time we actually met was in the 70s, and we had both begun to get a little bit of a name for ourselves because my picture was in the paper. I was writing a column for the News American at the time. He was already a big shot of merry-go-round. And we bumped into each other downtown one day and sat down to have a drink. And he said, "Yeah, I'm 4 years older than you, but I only graduated a year and a half ahead of you." And I said, "Because you went through high school on the 5-year plan." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I used to cheat on every test, but I would copy the wrong answers." Here's a guy who's a smart guy, but he grew up, his parents escaped Europe just in time. They got out just before Hitler could kill them. And they only spoke Yiddish. And he went to Talmudical Academy, where the primary language was Hebrew. So he's getting Hebrew in school, Yiddish at home, goes to public school in the 7th grade, starts out at Garrison Junior High, winds up at Pimlico Junior High later because he's got the same academic record. But look what happened. English was like a third language by the time they dumped him in public school. So he was way behind from the start. And, just felt like there's no hope here. He was drowning from the start. That's why he began to act out. Plus, the family had no money at all. The father was an inventor, so the mother threw him out. So there they were, living on nothing. He was impoverished. He was resentful. He was hustling any way he could and getting in trouble all the time. He sent the principal's office, Mr. E.O.'s hand, and Mr. posted him to being in his office, that one day he wandered out into the hall. And Boogie, told me this story years later, that he's sitting there in Yost's office just by himself, and he looks down, and Mr. Yost has left his desk door open, and he said, "There's all these blank report cards there. I only made one mistake." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I took all of them." So he had 200 blank report cards, which he was selling to any kid at school whose grades weren't that good and needed to pass one, pass their parents.
What you're saying is Boogie had a Xerox machine before anybody else did, pretty much?
Didn't have a Xerox machine, had the actual blank report cards, and was selling them for $1 or $5. I mean, that was a lot of money back in the early 60s. The other thing was, he had a brother who was a professional gambler, an older brother, who hustled what we all know as the football pools. The little cards with the point spread zone. His brother was connected to a guy on the block named Billy the Kid. And his brother's name, Boogie's brother's name was Eggie, who got the nickname from the shape of his head. And he said to Boogie, you know, you're going to high school with 3,000 kids, 3,000 guys at City. What would it hurt to hustle some football pools? And so Boogie was the guy to go to if you needed the football pool. And so you had all these guys at City College. I was one of them. You know, who didn't bet on football games back then? And so Boogie was also the star on the basketball team. I mean, he really was good. And there came a Friday afternoon when City was playing Poly in basketball. You know, the City-Poly rivalry. You know, it's like Army-Navy. It's big. So the basketball team is, I'm not making this up. I mean, Boogie told me this story, but so did Jerry Phipps, who was the basketball coach at City back then, who just died a couple of weeks ago, as Don and I talked about the other day. Terrific guy, Jerry Phipps. Anyway, basketball team is on the floor in the gym at City College with Polly, getting ready for tip-off. Boogie is in uniform also, but he's a little preoccupied. He is booking his last-minute football bets out by the side wall at City when he feels a large presence behind him, a guy grabbing him and lifting him into the air. It is the 300-pound football coach at City, a man we all know as George Young, who later went on to fame with the Baltimore Colts, with the New York Giants, who he led to a Super Bowl. And George Young was the football coach at City at the time and also a history teacher. And he grabs Boogie and says, "What do you think you're doing?" And Boogie looks up at him and says, "Just trying to make a living." George Young says, "You're coming with me." Takes him down to the gym where the stands are packed. Everybody's cheering. They're getting ready for the tip-off. Jerry Phipps is looking around. Where's my star guard, my big scorer? Here he comes being led by George Young. George Young says to Phipps, "I just found your young man outside booking illegal football bets." Jerry Phipps looks at Boogie and says, Leonard, get in the game. George Young looks at him and says, "You're going to let him play?" Jerry Phipps looks at him and says, "Hey, we're playing Polly." So he goes in, plays. Now, I looked it up in the yearbook. Boogie didn't even remember this, but I looked it up in the yearbook. City beat Polly that day. I think it was 70-57. Boogie scored 28 points that day.
So he wasn't even shook up. He wasn't even shook up.
He was used to this. This was who he was. He was, you know, he was the Fonz before the Fonz existed. He was a guy who had nothing to lose. And so he wasn't afraid to take all the chances that most of us, when we're 15, 16, 17 years old, are terrified to take, including, taking a chance with girls. He was fearless. You know, he got onto the Buddy Dean show, and that was the local TV station.
No small accomplishment getting on the Buddy Dean show.
No small accomplishment.
Don, you won on the Buddy Dean show, didn't you? They never let you on, right?
I did not, but I was in love with Mary Lou Raines for my entire childhood as a committee member.
Who wasn't in love with Mary Lou? Everybody of our generation was.
I want to get Mary Lou on the show. She's still around. Let's get her on.
She could be. I think she's still 17. But Boogie could boogie. He could dance. And that's where the nickname came from. But you know, anybody who knew him back then was like, this guy's going nowhere. You know, he's most likely to be paroled was if he had gotten any honor at all. But he hooked on with a clothing company, and they trained him to be a salesman, a traveling salesman. They sent him down to Atlanta, and he had the territory of about five states. But he felt, as he made the rounds, like these people down here have no sense of fashion at all. They didn't know the 60s had arrived. The era of the man in the gray flannel suit was over and it was time for, you know, jeans and being casual. And he's a guy who had a sense of fashion from not having money to buy clothes. He knew what the rich kids were wearing, but he also knew what anti-fashion was. And he wanted to have fashion based on kind of the secondhand clothing, the hand-me-down clothing that he had grown up with. And that's what he introduced in the South. A look of secondhand clothing that wasn't. Jeans that looked like secondhand that were torn.
They call them distressed now.
Yes,
they call
distressed.
Them.
And they were funky. And this is what kids wanted. They knew the 60s had arrived. Vietnam was here. There was a lot of stuff to rebel against. And they needed something to dress the part. And they started out with one store. It became an instant hit. Overnight, they had four stores, and then it just exploded.
Well, East Point Mall had a merry-go-round. It was right in the middle, and there where Santa Claus was in the new remodeled mall in the late 70s. I walked by it. I started shopping there in seventh grade ninth grade when I met Mr. Moeller, because the kids dressed GQ in the early 80s. And merry-go-round, Davy Jones Locker, those were the – Dom, were you too square to like shop at the merry-go-round in 71, 72 when it came on? Like, were you a hipster in that way when you were going out clubbing with Linda?
I tell you what I do remember, and it's embarrassing. This is where Michael's book is a trip down memory lane. Nestor, they start, as Michael talks about, they buy an abandoned store on a street that you wouldn't walk down on a bet in Atlanta. There's nothing else there. And there, I think as Michael describes it, the first weekend they're open, there are 1,500 people lined up around the store. And the next thing you know, the block is being rebuilt. And then I think it was Harold Goldsmith, right? His partner, Michael, that you write about, that suggests going into the malls, which really becomes a game changer. Do I have that right?
Yeah, because Harold realized you could get into the malls. Boogie knew it too. But Boogie was into, you know, the funky clothes, and he had a ponytail haircut.
Like this?
He looked like...
Yeah, just like that. Yeah, okay.
He says he looked like a second-class drug dealer, and the mall managers were not going to deal with that. Harold was a suit. He was a guy who looked the part, and he's the guy who could go to the mall managers. And after a while, when they saw what a hit it was, the mall managers were coming to them, and they were an enormous hit. They wound up with 1,500 stores around the country, 15,000 employees, and they were number 34 on Forbes magazine list of the best 200 corporations in America. They were making a fortune.
In the midst of all this, Michael,
you used to go into the stores, Nestor. Half the kids in Baltimore, half the kids in America were working in those stores.
But Michael, beneath all this also, so that we don't minimize, it is not just this rebel. There is this innate sense of fashion and what people wanted at the time, right? In other words, there was a brilliance to Boogie that sometimes can get lost, right?
Absolutely. He understood, as a street kid who hung out on the street corners of Baltimore and hung out at the old Hilltop Diner and hung out at Benny's Pool Hall and Nocco's Pool Hall, he didn't have the money to get what he felt the rich kids were wearing. He understood not only the fashion of it, but the culture of it, the sociology of it, the rebelliousness of it. And he was able to combine all of those things. And, you know, kind of the street rebel that so many of us feel we are when we're kids. We don't know exactly what we're rebelling against, but we know we're rebelling against something.
Michael Lesker is our guest. Don Moeller also riding shotgun today, doing some Baltimore positive. All of it brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets. We love these wise conversations. It's always a wise conversation when Michael Lesker is here. We do not spend enough time together. I guess you were laboring on this book. I mean, I see your columns all the time in JMOR. The boogie story, I'm familiar with most of it because of the Baltimore Bombers, even though some people in Owings Mills don't remember this, but I remember when we begged and pleaded for a football team, when we had Give Baltimore the Ball, when Bob Loeffler was marching the Glazer guys in here, and Boogie wanted a team, and everybody wanted a team, right? Everybody's going to be a part of this, and we wound up, none of them got the team, and Modell brought the team in here. But Boogie's story was well told by you and by many other people in the early 90s when he became sort of a dark horse candidate to be local boy done good by in the football team. And apparently, maybe they found out about those report cards or something, but the NFL guys, he didn't pass the suit sniff test the way maybe Dan Snyder did or this Jimmy Haslam fellow. But Boogie was in play, right? And certainly made a play to be a sports owner here before fortunes moved in a different direction. And I don't know the rest of the Boogie story. He's still alive, right? 30 years later, we've had a football team here. Tell me about Boogie since that point when he didn't get the football.
Well, he did. He knew from his own youth the love affair between the city and the Colts. And he was, he's a guy who spends a lot of his time, even now, in Baltimore. This is home for him. This is emotional turf for him. And when we lost the Colts and the NFL, made us dance their tune to that phony exhibition game in Baltimore that summer of
93. It's okay. I got you. I'm with you.
And he tried to buy a new team for Baltimore. He put up, I think, $100,000. You had to just to enter the possibility. And it was based on the love of Baltimore. And when they had the game, people were chanting that night in the stands. I was there. Give Boogie the ball. Give Boogie the ball. He captured people's imagination. Well, he didn't get the team. Eventually, of course, as you said, Modell brought the team here, and a brand new love affair has come to pass. Boogie, went on to do other things. He's become a tremendous philanthropist. He has given away tens of millions of dollars from not only organized charities, but he'll spot a story in the newspaper that somebody had a terrible accident and they can't afford their medical bills, and he will take over that person's life and pay their medical bills. His money people told me that he'll be standing in line at Lenny's Deli out on Ricestown Road in Owings Mills, and some guy starts to tell him a hard luck story, and Boogie gives the guy $5,000. He's the world's easiest touch. He has a huge heart because he remembers his own tough times.
Well, Michael, with that, so many anecdotes. Tell Nestor, two things come to mind. Nestor, I don't know if you knew this story. I actually was at watching my son play, my grandson play JV baseball yesterday. And I was telling some friends who were at the game, the 1973 story, when Hofberger sells the team, Nestor, it blew me away, sold the team for $12 million. Goldsmith has a meeting set up, and Boogie and Goldsmith get into a fight because Boogie won't put on a suit, and he blows off the meeting, right? Am I accurate?
It was typical Boogie. He was not going to dance to somebody else's tune. He was going to be who Boogie was going to be. Harold Goldsmith, his partner at the time, sets up a meeting with Jerry Hofberger. No other local investors had come in, and we were very nervous back then because we had already, we were about to lose the Colts. Boogie said, I'm not dressing up for this. And Harold said, you can't embarrass me. And Boogie says, I am who I am. Harold says, I'm not going like that. And Boogie says, then we're not going. And so,
well, Boogie could have grabbed anything off the racket merry-go-round.
But he wouldn't put, he did not.
I mean, it's different times. You couldn't be walking into a meeting with bell bottoms in 1977. I mean, like it was a banker's world. It was a suit and tie world.
He was not going to be somebody who he wasn't. He had fought so hard to establish who he was on his own terms that he was not going to suddenly be less than loyal to the person he had worked so hard to become.
Moeller's still trying to work through that with me. I keep telling Moeller that's who I am. And he,
get us,
you know.
Get us. Well, before, I don't want to get away from the segment before we talk about race and class and all that segregation, because that's a sub theme to all of this. But Michael, I would be remiss, and Nestor, there's a book in itself, and while we'll keep the show G-rated, there is a character, Michael, in your book who in 2022 would probably be in jail, but I found her to be one of the most interesting characters in your entire book. And that, of course, I have on my notes, Kank, Kank, Kank. There is a lady down the block who goes by Kank. Keep it G-rated, but tell us about Kank.
Well, Kank was a middle-aged lady who was legendary in Northwest Baltimore, that she would provide a service for free for teenage boys looking to lose their innocence. She happened to live a couple of doors away from Boogie, and so they became close, shall we say. But he also would hang out at her house whenever he would get into trouble, because if he got into trouble, his mother would be upset. His mother would tell his big brother, Jackie, who would then beat up Boogie for getting into trouble. And so Boogie would hang out at Kank's. So by the time he was in high school and had gotten into trouble repeatedly, and was getting sent down to the principal's office, Mr. Yost again. And Henry Yost, at the principal at City, calls Boogie into his office, and he says, "You're suspended." He had found out about the blank report cards. He had found out about the football pools. He had found out about the cheating in class. And you can't come back to school until you bring your mother with you. And Boogie says, "My mother, this will kill her. This will just," and then she'll tell Jackie, my brother, and Jackie will beat the hell out of me. And to bring my mother up, this will just be awful. And so he doesn't. He doesn't bring his mother up to school. He brings Kank. He brings Kank. I mean, imagine, the principal has told you to bring your mother, and you figure, I can get away with it by bringing some other woman. And he brings Kank, and Henry Yost proceeds to tell her, you know, your son is this and your son is that. And Kank gets offended. And she, you can't talk about my son like this. And she and Henry Yost get into an argument about, you know, you can't talk about my son like this. And Henry Yost says, all right, I'll let him back into school. How he got away with the stuff that he got away with. He was fearless. What did he have to lose? So, you know, that's kind of a lesson for anybody who's struggling in school. Take your chances, but bear down, be yourself. And it's a lesson to every grown-up. Don't judge a kid based strictly on his high school transcript. There's all kinds of stuff going on at home. There's all kinds of stuff going on the street corners. You don't know what this kid's going through in the rest of his life. And so there are lessons in Boogie Wineglass's life beyond the street kid, beyond the fabulous millions of dollars that he wound up making, much of which he's given away. But it's to have the courage to live your life, to believe in yourself, and to get on with it.
Michael, the last, we could talk anecdotes for 3 hours, but I want you to talk a little bit, because the reason I'm so convinced this will be either a Netflix film or an HBO series, hopefully with Levinson directing it and you as a consultant.
Sure.
Are the underlying themes of racial discrimination, religious separation, the segregation of Baltimore actually being divided right down the middle of a street, and Boogie's resentment of that, what he saw, the division of the classes in America. That to me, if I'm a big time English professor, that's what I'm having my students write on.
He to this day says, I'm against prejudice of any kind. He grew up in one changing neighborhood after another. He played basketball at a time, and most people don't know this. The Supreme Court decision to integrate the schools was 1954, Brown versus Board of Education. It wasn't for a number of years after that that the county schools around here integrated. I mean, they really dragged their feet. But the city of Baltimore did it right away. Tommy D'Alessandro the Elder was the mayor at the time, and Walter Sondheim was head of the Board of Education. And Sondheim went to Tommy and he said, well, the Supreme Court says, you know, do it. What do you think? And Tommy said, I spoke with the priests, and the priests said it's the right thing to do. And so Baltimore City did it right away. But the guys running the old MSA, the Maryland Scholastic Association, which was the sports umbrella, they didn't do it for another 3 years. The classrooms of the city of Baltimore were integrated, but the football and basketball, in other words, Douglas, Dunbar, Carver, the traditionally black high schools, their kids were not allowed for another 3 years. So Boogie was really in that first generation of kids who were playing integrated high school basketball. It didn't matter to him at all. He wasn't inhibited at all by this. He had grown up in neighborhoods that were mixed. And he was one of the few guys back then who had a black girlfriend. He was going to do what Boogie was going to do. He has always been against prejudice of any kind.
Michael Oesker is our guest. New book on Boogie Wonka. You waited your whole life to write this book, haven't you? You've been writing this in a series of columns for the last 40 years, right?
Well, you know, the old message is write what you know. And one of the gifts I had to write this book was that I was part of that generation. And I was there in Baltimore. I was there in Northwest Baltimore for a lot of it. I was at City College, which was the great melting pot of the city of Baltimore. And, you know, the stuff that you guys, you know, were growing up with, I was growing up with too, but Boogie's generation was mine. And so this felt like writing a letter to a generation in a sense, writing a love letter to a generation as well.
Well, your columns still get a lot of reaction from a lot of folks, not Don, and lots of folks on my, you're enjoying this part of your career in writing? I mean, still clearly have an audience, man.
People have been lovely. I'm astonished all the time when I walk down the street and people come up and say hello. It's like therapy. And we talk about the Baltimore that we love. We do love this place. I've been here since I'm 4 years old. My father and mother grew up in the Bronx. My father was a freshman at NYU who dropped out the day after Pearl Harbor to join the Air Force. And we moved down to Baltimore after the war, 1949, so he could resume his schooling. We lived in the Latrobe housing projects for 4 years over in East Baltimore, right by the penitentiary. And then when I was 8 years old, moved out to Northwest Baltimore, a short walk from the Hilltop Diner. And so that's my childhood background. And Baltimore took in my family, and I will always be grateful for that. It's I didn't get here until I'm 4 years old, but Baltimore has embraced me and my family ever since.
Nestor, I don't know if you remember. I think I may have shared this story with Michael when we had him on before. But I think it really does speak to what talent looks like. I was fortunate to teach with a terrific English teacher at Lansdowne High School named Gary Levin. And Gary and I became buddies, and he was just a great guy, great teacher. And in our discussions, he points out to me that he and Michael were on the Diamondback together.
And, No. I was the sports editor of the City College Collegian, and he was sports editor of the Poly Press.
Oh, there it is.
So, but also we were roommates for a year in college at University of Maryland.
Okay, you're roommates at University of Maryland. So I said to him, well, Gary, Michael went on to become this big-time columnist, and I love that you're a teacher, but why didn't you become a columnist? And he said, Don, I may not be the brightest bulb in the batch, but I understand certain things. I would write something, and I'd look at what I wrote, and then I'd look at what Olesker wrote, and I thought, okay, I guess I'll be a teacher. I mean, he basically said, what Michael was writing, I just couldn't write like that. So he paid you the highest compliment.
He's lying. He's lying, though. the fact is, Gary is a terrific writer. He's one of the brightest people that I know. He's a terrific writer. He's a funny writer. But his gift to Baltimore was that he became a school teacher for 35 years. He was a wonderful,
terrific teacher.
He's a hero of mine for that. Whereas, like him, I was struggling to find my way in high school, and what looked to him like it came easy to me was not. I used to struggle like crazy. I would sit there at the typewriter. The guys on the Collegian were all in the A course. They were all geniuses, and then there was me, and I had this terrible inferiority complex, sit there at the typewriter, struggling to write my piece, would turn it into one of these geniuses, a kid named Robert Miller, whose IQ was higher than my weight, and he would read it over every week and look for something nice to say about it. And every week he would say the same thing to me. He would say, it's very well typed. That was the best. That was the best he could come up with. It's well typed.
What's a better ending than that, Nestor? Boogie, life on a merry-go-round. Hey, Nestor, let me just, we've got Michael here, one of my little tabs. He ends like this. And tell me this doesn't make you want to rush out and get the book. His last words about Boogie in this book, he's flying high over America. He's living the dream in that rarefied atmosphere few have ever known. No one will ever take this life away from him. He's irrepressible. He's doing what he loves best. He's spreading the wealth around and the fun. It's beautiful. It's a smile. It's Boogie. Folks, can't get any better than that. Michael Olesker, Boogie, Life on a Merry-Go-Round.
Michael, I've never chatted with Boogie Wineglass. I've been in the same room with him once or twice, but I've never spoken to him. I was always a little intimidated. So I was always figuring I wasn't dressed well enough. So at some point...
Are you kidding?
At some point, I have to get Boogie on and show him all my 70s gear. Michael, love you. Appreciate you. Thanks for being my crazy uncle all those years and all those bookmaker salads down at Sabatino's many, many years ago. I hope sometime soon I'll bring you down to Amici's. We'll get some meatballs or something, all right?
Let's do it. I love you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Michael Olesker, so read his work out of Jay Moore. Follow him out on the social media. He's my Facebook friend. He can be yours as well. The new book is available anywhere fine books are sold. And Don was tickled to get the book and as well as read it. You can find me anywhere the crab cake is served right now. I'll be at Greenmount Station this week. All presented by the Maryland Lottery. Got some Betty Boop scratch-off tickets we'll be giving away, as well as our friends at Goodwill Industries. We're going to be taking the tour on the road in May and June. I got some big news. We're going to be at G&O Coney Island Hot Dog next Friday, the 22nd, in White Marsh, new location from Baltimore with love. And the 27th, we're going to be at Conrad's Crabs in Perry Hall. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive and High School Guidance Counselor, Dundalk High School, 1982, Don Moeller, I am Nestor Aparicio. No wonder I turned out so good. We are WNST AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.